It's Friday, the 10th of June, 2016. Happy birthday to Jeff Teague. Show brought to you by Fantrax and Joytops LLC on Twitter / Insta. That's an interesting iTunes name. If you want to be like Joytops S LLC on Twitter / Insta, all you need to do is leave a review on iTunes and you can become a sponsor of the podcast. So thank you, Joytops LLC on Twitter, Insta. What an interesting name. I assume that you can find Joytops S LLC on Twitter and Instagram at that account. That's enough exposure for you, Joytops. If you've got a sec, it's great if you could leave a review on iTunes. It does help the podcast out immensely in getting out to more people and soaring up the rankings. So thank you to everybody who has done that. We are going to be talking about, in today's show, the Charlotte Hornets season in review. A huge surprise, if you're maybe not a surprise, but a great season if you're a Hornets fan, given the disappointment of the season before, you know, to get themselves tied with the third seed in the Eastern Conference, take the Heat through to seven games, all while missing Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, who had that shoulder injury in the preseason, thought he was out for the year, came back, and then was out for the year again. Pretty impressive stuff from the Hornets, given they're not an old team, they're not an overly young team, but they're a team who looked pretty good. So I think Hornets fans would be pretty impressed with the season they put together. Before we get into any more about the Charlotte Hornets, though,
let's get to it.
Of course, Michael Bolton. The Charlotte Hornets, they finished with a 48-34 record, as I mentioned, tied with the Hawks, the Celtics, and the Heat for that third seed. Lost in seven games to the Heat after having a 3-2 lead. Probably a disappointing way to end the season, but in the end, everyone's season ends disappointingly, apart from one team. That's the way that sports works. And if you look at every season where you don't win the championship as a complete disaster and utter failure, then I think you're approaching sports in the wrong way. Obviously, it's everyone's goal, but the Hornets, you have to be impressed with that sort of jump from being a lottery team to being tied third in the Eastern Conference. It's a big jump up. Now, they have pick 22 in this upcoming draft. No other picks, no second round picks, and I wouldn't say that they're primed to get better, but there's a big chance that they can get better based on the way that the team looks. Now, they do have some unrestricted free agents to take care of and some interesting decisions to make. They've got Nick Batum, who is for all likelihood going to receive a max deal. They brought him across in that trade with the Portland Trailblazers last offseason for Noel Vonleh and Gerald Henderson, and to me it was a massive win for the Hornets at the time. Yes, Batum was on a one-year deal, but I did not rate Henderson at all. He's an unrestricted free agent himself, and I don't rate Vonleh, and I think it works out well. And from all reports, everything I've seen is Batum is going to re-sign in Charlotte. He's only 27 years old, so he's not old. He is right hitting the prime of his career now. If he signs a five-year deal, he becomes 32. Yeah, 32 Nick Batum's not the same as 27 Nick Batum, but it's not the same as having a 35-year-old Al Horford on your team, which the Hawks might do if they sign him to a five-year max. So Batum is at a perfect stage to sign for a max deal, and he was a key part of this team. And you hear me talk about Nick Batum a lot, which I'll get into a little bit later, but he's likely to re-sign. Al Jefferson is an unrestricted free agent as well. Not the biggest Al Jefferson fan. If they bring him back, it should strictly be in a bench role as the backup who plays 20 minutes a night. That's to me where he fits. Marvin Williams is an unrestricted free agent, and he was a massive part of their success. Still bafflingly, you know what I mean? Confusingly, that's a better word because I can actually pronounce that word. It was confusingly good. I didn't understand how Marvin Williams all of a sudden became a good player, but he was a key part to their postseason push, and they'll be looking to bring him back. Now, he's 29 years old. He's shown one good season, basically, in his career. Can he repeat it? Can he do it again? What sort of money they're going to give him? It won't be max money, but it's obviously going to be money in the eight digits. Courtney Lee, also an unrestricted free agent, a guy they brought over in the trade deadline in that PJ Hairston deal, who was essentially brought over because Michael Kidd-Gilchrist was out for the rest of the season. They looked to increase their defense in that starting lineup and get a better player than PJ Hairston, who had been starting for them. Now, whether Courtney Lee comes back remains to be seen, because I think that when Kidd-Gilchrist returns and with Batum returning, then Lee's not going to have a spot as a starter. Lee is not the greatest fantasy player, but he does provide quite a bit for the team in terms of his on-court stuff. Tyler Hansbrough, Psycho T, is 30 years old, if you can believe that. He's an unrestricted free agent. Whether he comes back or not, it makes no difference. And Jorge Gutierrez and Troy Daniels are both restricted free agents. Gutierrez, I don't think there's much point. And yeah, he's not going to be a priority. Daniels at 24, you'd be interested in bringing him back if the money is right, because he can provide some shooting. And this team took their season in a completely different direction to what they did last year, considering they barely hit any threes in 2014-15, and then they become three-point happy. And that was all credit goes to the players and to Steve Clifford for introducing a new scheme in one off-season and becoming a completely different team. And it worked wonders for them. Brought in some extra players, but that's sort of the way that they're going to have to start moving, and the way, obviously, the NBA is moving as well. So yeah, Daniels has that ability as a player who can hit threes and provide that sort of spark plug role off the bench. So they're the players who they've got to make some decisions on heading into the off-season. Let's talk about these players from a fantasy point of view. And Kemba Walker, one of the biggest surprises of the season. I've been a big Kemba Walker fan for quite a while. He's a guy that I do go after in fantasy drafts a lot of the time, because I'm pretty happy to punt field goal percentage, which is a real concern from him. But he took a big jump this year. He went from 53rd in 9 cat leagues all the way up to 17th, so a top 20 player, which I don't think many people would have seen coming. And he went 60th in 8 cat down to 20th. So big, big jumps, and on off of 4.3. And overall, you couldn't be more impressed with what Kemba Walker did this season. He played 36 minutes a game. He's almost the spiritual leader of this team. He only played 62 games the year before, and he was a lot healthier this year. Averaged 21 points a game, over 20 for the first time in his career, and that's a four-point jump there. He hit 2.2 triples, another significant jump, over a 50% increase on his output from the year before. He grabbed 4.3 rebounds. That's more rebounds a game. The same assists, 1.6 steals, more steals. Half a block, which is incredibly valuable for a point guard. Most point guards don't get that. He is one of the best shot-blocking point guards in the game, obviously behind John Wall, but he's one of those guys. He took his field goal percentage up from 39% up to 42%. It's a big jump, and he was a guy that was almost punt. You know, you have to punt field goal percentage to a guy where, yeah, his field goal percentage isn't great. 42 on 17 attempts isn't great, but it means he doesn't have to be a full-on punt strategy. He still would have been even better in a situation where you were punting field goal percentage, obviously, as that number. Well, you don't have to worry about dealing with that negative 1.4 Z score for that category when he's taking so many shots. If he was at 45%, then would it be even better? But 42 is manageable. He was a guy that you couldn't really deal with in rotisserie leagues prior, but this year he became a roto threat, and he's a great free throw shooter. 85% he hit, and he took his three-point percentage up from 30 to 37. That's a big jump. His previous seasons, he shot 31, 32, 33, 30, and up to 37. So that's a big jump. And we sort of hypothesized on this in the preseason. Is Kemba Walker going to take a jump? And I thought, yes, he would, because of the additional better players, especially Nick Batum. Someone who could facilitate, like Batum, and someone else who could shoot, which they didn't have. And basically, Kemba Walker's field goal percentage, a lot of that poor field goal percentage was due to the fact that he was taking bailout shots, because the other players on their team were like, oh, we don't know what to do, give it to Kemba. And Kemba was like, cool, there's 4 seconds left on the shot clock. I'm going to have to take a contested shot from three with three guys around me, leaning back, fading away. And it's not going to go in. But with more spacing, with more ball movement, with Batum out there as a secondary creator who can allow Kemba to play off the ball for small periods of time, then Walker's shot selection was able to improve. His shot quality was able to improve. And we saw it manifest in comfortably his best NBA season. Comfortably, he was also the leader on this team in win shares at 9.9, and he finished third on the team in win shares per 48, second if you're not going to include the 63 minutes that Jorge Gutierrez played, and I don't think you should. Defensively, he was a zero. Yep, absolute zero. That's okay for a point guard. A lot of point guards are negatives. There are some that are positives, but as a starting point guard who's handling such a big load offensively, to be a zero as a defensive box score plus minus, it's a win. And then he puts up a 4 in offensive box score plus minus. Obviously, that's great. A PER of almost 21. He almost got his true shooting up to 56. He was at 55.5. Can't ask for much more than that from Kemba Walker. He is on a ridiculously valuable contract. He's 26 years old. He's going to be paid $12 million for the next three seasons. That is going to seem like one of the steals in the NBA. At 26 years old, I might not be banking on a top 20 season again from Kemba, but he should be able to be a top 30, top 35 guy. Easily a guy that you pick in the first three rounds. But there is that possibility. If the field goal percentage drops from 42 to 40, then rotisserie becomes a little bit harder and you have to be more willing to embrace a punt. And I still think that, you know, he fits best in a situation where you are punting field goals, but everything else improved. His three-point shooting, his three-point output, his rebounding, his steals, his scoring, all that stuff, his free throw percentage, all that stuff improved as well. And there's a chance that he can continue to get better. I do really like Kemba Walker. Speaking of players that I do really like, Nick Batum. Massive fan of Nick Batum, and I know a lot of people who either listen to me on this podcast aren't, or follow me on Twitter aren't, because the amount of questions I get about Nick Batum last season as well, he's trash, he's garbage, cutting him, dropping him in keeper leagues. And then this season when he had a slump coming back from an injury in January, oh, I've got to get rid of Batum. Like, you're crazy. It makes no sense to me. Batum is one of the best fantasy players when he's going around. Last season, it was a disappointing year for him, no doubt. He was battling wrist injuries for basically the rest of the whole season. I think he injured it in November, and the whole season he battled a wrist injury. He was dealing with some personal upheaval, which threw him around as well. He wasn't happy in Portland, it appears, given some recent quotes coming out from him. But overall, his season wasn't as bad as people made out. He was 69th last season. This season, he was 59th. So yeah, it's a bit of a jump, but it's not a huge jump. He did take his 8 cat numbers up pretty significantly, and that's good. He went from 74th to 36th. So that's a big jump there, and that's partially because his turnovers saw a big increase this season as he was handling the ball a little bit more. It wasn't in Damian Lillard's hands as much as what it was in Portland, but his numbers took a big jump. He went from averaging 9.4 points to 14.7. He took his three-pointers from 1.4 to 1.9. He got the same rebounds. He added an extra 0.7 assists and averaged 5.5 assists. And as a small forward, that is just ridiculously valuable. He had 0.9 steals, he had 0.6 blocks, and he shot 42 and 85, including 34.5 from three. Batum, I said, he's going to get that big contract. He was a 4.7 on-off for this team, one of the best on the team in that particular metric. And he's the guy that I think is going to remain in that 8 category sort of system. He's going to be a top 50 player. 9 cat, because he will be handling the ball, it's going to drop him down. But again, I don't care about the turnovers. I'm really happy to take him inside the top 50. But you might be in a league filled with 11 other players who think the same about Batum and go, he's garbage. Ugh, he was terrible again. And it's just not accurate. Yes, he only averaged 14 points. Fine. But 6 assists, 5.5 rebounds, 2 threes, a steal, half a block, 42 and 85. Those numbers are really, really good across the board. And he's a comfortable top 50 player to me. I think he's a comfortable top 50 player for the next 3 to 4 seasons. I don't really see him... I don't see his game fading a huge amount as he heads into his 30s. Yeah, it will, obviously, at some point, but he'll still hit his threes. He'll still have the court vision. He'll still have some of his defensive ability. Maybe when he gets past 30, that drops off somewhat. But he was a key addition to this team, and one of the reasons they jumped so high in the standings. We look at where he ranks in win shares. He was 4th on the team. Really good defensive numbers as well. 1.1 box score offensive, 0.9 defensive. So basically the same. One of the top players there. His true shooting is only less than 55 and a PER of 15. So not great numbers there. But still, we can see by his fantasy numbers how much of an improvement Batum had on the season prior, and how good of an asset he is. And I might get to it now instead of leaving this question till later. But Justin Gutterman, I'm going to say Gutterman, says, Nick Batum or Evan Fournier for your fantasy life partner? It's a good question. I do like French guys. Fournier, I've been on him for a while, but he's not as good as Batum. He won't be as good as Batum. I was more on the Fournier bandwagon because there was nobody who liked Evan Fournier, and he was the man that I was running with. Batum, though, is a real favourite of mine. I've had him in so many fantasy leagues over the course of my fantasy playing career. If I'm picking one of those guys, Batum is the better option to me. Zubin Petrao actually chimes in with a question live, so I might as well answer that now. He says, if you were Masai Ujiri, I would have a lot more money for a start. If you were Masai Ujiri, would you sign Batum over DeRozan? Yeah, Batum's a better player than DeRozan, but in terms of what the Raptors want to do, Batum's not going to be that sort of scorer. DeRozan's got a really interesting game in his ability to draw free throws and to score, and he's a decent ball handler and decent distributor. I think Batum is the better option, but it might put some more pressure on some of these other players to become better scorers. Overall, if I had to make the decision, I would pick Batum over DeRozan personally. Interesting to see what you guys think, actually. Would you take DeRozan or Nick Batum? Marvin Williams. I was pretty adamant that I'm not a Marvin Williams fan, but he had to be owned basically all of the season. He was the 49th ranked player in 9-cat leagues. You let that sink in the 49th. He was 125th last season. He was 73rd in 8-cat leagues, so his numbers are obviously fueled by some low turnover numbers, but still 75 is pretty impressive. Williams started the season, basically all the season at power forward, and that was something I was against at the start of the season. I wanted to see Cody Zeller as the power forward. We'll talk about Cody Zeller soon. But they gave the role to Williams, and he played 29 minutes a game. He averaged 11.2 points, which is the first time in four seasons that he's got over double digits. He hit 1.8 threes at 40%, which is just ridiculously efficient. Grabbed 6.5 rebounds, had 0.7 steals and 0.9 blocks, shot 44 and 82, and took that free throw percentage up by 11%. That is a big jump. Yeah, the 4% from three is a big jump, but 11 from the free throw line is a huge jump. He hadn't hit 80% of his free throws since the 2010-11 season. So Marvin Williams with a really huge sort of season. Again, the turnovers do fuel his top 50 NICAT rank at 0.7. I wouldn't be looking at him anywhere near that top 50. To me, he's a guy that you look at in that 90 to 80 range. And at 29 years of age in dynasty formats, he's a great sort of win now player. But if you're building for the future, then I think that his game is going to drop off pretty significantly, and his role will drop off, I think, in about 2 years' time, 3 years' time. He could become a nice bench piece. He's not a player that you build your foundation around as a team or as a fantasy squad, thinking that this is a guy who's... He didn't even play 30 minutes a game this year, and that will start to trend down in about two seasons' time. In terms of what he did advanced numbers-wise, on-off, he was a 4 plus 4.9, so the best player on the team in terms of his on-off numbers. In terms of his win share numbers, he was second on the team in win shares. In terms of win shares per 48, he was third on the team. He posted positive offensive and defensive box score plus minus for a second on the team in box score plus minus. His PER was good. His true shooting was amazing. Honestly, he had just a fantastic season. And for a guy who doesn't like Marvin Williams, he was a guy that I thought should have been considered as the most improved player. I thought what he was able to do at his age and to be able to put in a season like that was tremendous, and it was something that I could not have predicted he was going to be that good. To predict he's going to be that good again, maybe he won't get better. I'm pretty confident in saying that he won't get better, but he might drop off a bit. But I think that you might see one more season of him in that sort of role. But with the Hornets having Frank Kaminsky, who they want to play as the four, and obviously 6-7 years younger than what Marvin Williams is, Williams in the next 2 years, I imagine he'll start again next season, but I think he could be starting to get phased out if they happen to re-sign him in those next two seasons. If you look at his career numbers, this is clearly his best season in terms of his box score plus minus, in his win shares per 48, in his win shares, in his VORP, in his PER, his best true shooting season. Everything about this season was the best that he's ever done, and that's really amazing for a guy that's played in the NBA 11 seasons and is 29 years of age and turning 30. It's a pretty amazing feat from Marvin Williams, but amazing feats don't normally repeat themselves, and it's unlikely he takes another step forward. So there's no chance. There is no chance. No chance at all. No chance in hell I'll be taking him in the top 50 next season. I don't care that he finished as a top 50 player in 9-cat leagues. There is no chance that he is a top 50 player next season to me, and I will write that down now. You can retweet it to me when he's a top 10 player next season. I don't care. There is no way that he is a top 50 pick to me. And yes, he was the 49th ranked player, and yes, he was doing stuff that was out of control in low minutes, but I cannot see it. These jumps, is it sustainable, and are his minutes sustainable? That is the question for Marv. I think he's more of a 70 to 80 guy next season. Again, it's really too early to tell all this stuff, but a huge season, and if you grabbed him off the waiver, because let's be honest, you didn't draft Marvin Williams unless your league goes 16 teams. You didn't draft him, but if you picked him up, you would have been happy, or really happy, with riding him all season long. This team's got quite a few of my boyfriends. Yeah, Marvin Williams isn't the anti-boyfriend, but Nick Batum is a guy I really like. Kemba Walker's a guy I really like. Cody Zeller is a guy I probably irrationally like. And I did like the fact that what he did this season. Now, his game is not the most fantasy-friendly, but I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that Cody Zeller was the 103rd ranked player in 9-cat leagues. Post All-Star, he was ranked 89th, and in 8-cat, he was 131st. Obviously, the low turnovers, again, inflate that number, but he played very, very few minutes. He played just 24 minutes a game, or under 24 minutes a game. He only averaged 8.7 points, so he's another one of those guys that people look at and go, he can't even score 9 points. Trash. No, no, he's not trash. He's actually really good. He was a 3.3 positive in on-off numbers. He was one of the best defenders on this team. In terms of, if we look at their look at the NBA.com defensive numbers, in terms of players who played a legit amount of minutes, he had the best defense against opposition shooting. So when I say that, is that opponents against him shot 44.9%, with their usual shooting percentage is 47.6. So a difference of 2.6. The three guys ahead of him didn't play. Aaron Harrison, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, and Troy Daniels. They played, combined between them, they played less than 60 games. So, yes, they were better, but the sample size of those guys playing and the minutes those guys played was so minuscule. Out of the regular contributors on this team, Zeller was the best defender. He impacted opposition defense the most. He is a very good real-life player to me, and again, I might go bold again. He will be the starting center on this team next year. It should not be Al Jefferson. Maybe they bring him back, but Jefferson's 31 years of age. He's slow. He looked, yes, he battled injuries, but he's battled injuries the last two seasons. It's taken a lot out of him. The game is not suited to what he does as a starter, and Zeller needs to play more than 24 minutes a night, and he can comfortably become that player who is a top 100 guy in 8-cat and 9-cat leagues, but won't ever really be better than probably top 90, but could comfortably just be that guy who sits in there in that range at the end of a draft where you're looking for a player who's not going to hurt your percentages, which is exactly what he does. Now, he did average 8.7 points, but 6.2 boards, he got 0.7 steals, 0.8 blocks, 53 and 76. I think he does have the ability to develop. Maybe it takes 2 to 3 more years for him to hit a three-pointer, maybe 0.2, 0.3 a game at a decent percentage. The really solid percentages is good for him. You put him at 30 minutes, you're going to get a steal, you're going to get a block a game, you're going to get 7.5 rebounds, and you'll probably get 10 or 11 points. And these aren't spectacular numbers. They don't have massive room for growth, but they're good. And I think he's a really good player. And I do think that he can continue to grow with this team and become a real defensive, not linchpin. Like, he's not an awesome defender, but he's a lot better than you anticipate. He's a lot better than you think. He's the best rim protector this team has. He's probably the best defensive big man. Well, he is the best defensive big man that this team has. And a lot of people don't value Cody Zeller, probably because he's tall and white. Maybe that's part of it as well. But he's quite good. He's decently athletic. His ability on offense is not great, but he knows what his role is. He's a decent passer, and he's efficient. I really like him, but doesn't necessarily mean it translates into fantasy. I don't ever see him becoming a top 50 player. Not happening. Top 75, maybe one or two seasons. But I can see him having a four-season stretch of being just around that 90 to 110 mark and in that sort of ranking range. That's sort of how I view Cody Zeller. Al Jefferson. I was pretty harsh on Al Jefferson for big parts of the season. And a lot of the way that I talk about players on this podcast in general is in relationship to perception. So, I'll be more railing on people thinking, Al Jefferson, we have to stash him. That's what my issue was. Oh, we've got to stash Al Jefferson. We've got to stash him. He's coming back from his knee injury. Let's everyone grab him. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, Jefferson's not that good. He's not going to start. Yes, he started the last two games of the playoffs. That's where he started. In a matchup situation, which happens in playoffs. Matchups change all the time. But he wasn't good. He struggled. He would have games where he'd come out and score 12 points, and people, let's go grab Al Jefferson, because they remember 2 years ago when he was a 20-10 guy. He's nowhere near that anymore. And then he scored 4 points in the next game. Overall, his ranking numbers were okay. 104th in NICAP, almost the same as Zeller. And his game is a lot more fantasy-friendly than Cody Zeller. Absolutely. He was 135th in 8-cat leagues, but unlike Zeller, he took a big step back post-All-Star. His ranking went from 90 to 123. They played very similar minutes, 23.5 minutes for Jefferson. He averaged 12.1 points and 6.4 rebounds, both higher than what Zeller did. He averaged 1.4 assists, higher than Zeller. He averaged 0.8 blocks, the same as Zeller, but 49 from the field, 65 from the free throw line. These aren't great numbers. And the other thing is in terms of his on-off numbers, negative 0.1. His advanced numbers, yes, you put these two guys and you play them the same minutes, Jefferson will be the better fantasy contributor. But you know what Steve Clifford doesn't do? When he's looking at his rotation and his lineups, he doesn't go, well, you know, guys, Al Jefferson probably going to have more fantasy numbers if we start him, so let's put him in there. That's not what he does. And it's true that he will have more fantasy numbers if they play the same minutes. But Zala will be the better contributor. He will help the team more on defense massively. He will help the team more on offense. He's more able to be in flow with a modern offense than what Jefferson is. If we look at Jefferson's defensive... Did I even talk about Zeller's? No, I didn't even talk about Zeller's advanced numbers. He was third on the team in win shares. He led the team in win shares per 48. He led the team in defensive box score plus minus. He was third on the team in total box score plus minus. He had a PER of 16.1, which was higher than Nick Batum. He had big numbers. He had the second highest block percentage on this team. Al Jefferson was the guy above him at 3. But when you look at Jefferson's numbers, yes, he had a defensive box score plus minus of 1.2, but that was behind Spencer Hawes and Zeller. He had a negative 1.1 box score plus minus because his offense was really poor. His win shares were down the list. His win shares per 48 were 7th on the, or 6th on the team. Nothing about what Jefferson did to me was as good as what Zeller did. But he does have a role. He's got a 20-minute role in the league. It should be 20 Jefferson, 28 Zeller if they bring him back. They might not bring him back, but he's got to be willing to accept that he's probably not a starter in the NBA anymore. And he's 31 years of age. It is not going to get better for Jefferson at this point. He's likely going to get worse. And we look at what he did in terms of stat production. He only averaged 12 points, 6.5 rebounds. But it's more important to look on a per 36 basis because he went from playing 31 minutes a game down to 23 minutes a game. And yes, just two seasons ago, he was a top 20 player. Oh, sorry, he was a top 25. He was ranked 25th two seasons ago. That was playing 35 minutes, averaging 22 and 11 and a block a game at 51 and 69. But the field goal percentage dropped down to 49. The free throws still aren't good. The defense isn't there. Can't keep on the court as much. Only played 54 games. A lot not to like about Jefferson. His per 36 numbers, the rebounds dipped slightly. The scoring dropped slightly. The blocks dropped slightly. All these things that we sort of anticipate happening as you get older. And that's, to me, where Al Jefferson is. If you're in a league that's a dynasty or a keeper and you own Al Jefferson, you have to explore the market because people like him. And I've talked about this plenty of times, the psychology of fantasy basketball. People don't like Nick Batum. When he's in a slump, you buy him low as possible. People like Al Jefferson. They really love him. Let's see who believes in Al Jefferson in your league. Jefferson, he was hurt last year, guys. He's probably going to... Zeller. Cody Zeller, he's useless. What can he do? Al Jefferson's going to be the starting center for this team. He's a 20-10 guy, baby. Do you want him? Sell him. Sell up the bullshit hype. Sell up the narrative. And trade him away. Because it's not going to happen. He won't be the starting center on this team or any other team. And if he is, that team will be bad. All his on-court metrics look poor. His defense isn't great. It's okay, but it's not great. It's not Cody Zeller level defense. And he's 31, and Zeller's 25. And he doesn't fit the timeline of this team being good. Plus, the decline is happening. His knees are shot. He's fat a lot of the time. You need to be happy to make those decisions. Hey, yeah, Jefferson will probably start next year, guys. He only got benched because he came back from an injury. Get rid of him. He was a 20-10 guy 2 years ago. Two years ago, guys. Come on. Just give me something. Give me a top 75 player. And if you get that, it's a steal. But that's where you need to understand perception. And I'll try to bring you players, people's perception as much as possible from my interactions on Twitter and see the way that people think and try and get you to use that to your advantage. And I think you can. With some players, it doesn't work because there's not much of a groundswell of support in any one direction. But Batum is definitely a guy that gets hated on very quickly. Jefferson gets loved really quickly. Everyone is just very much ready to anoint Al Jefferson the savior of their fantasy team. And it's just not going to be the case. Mick, Kid Gilchrist, MKG. I was really, really looking forward to a breakout from Michael Kidd Gilchrist. He'd signed that rookie extension. He was ready to go. I thought, you know what? His jump shot has improved, and he takes the shots he knows he can hit. He doesn't stretch himself, so his field goal percentage for fantasy is really good. Even he might start hitting some threes. His defense is absolutely superb, so he's going to have to stay on the court. And he can translate that good defense into defensive numbers. What if he starts blocking shots? What if he starts getting steals? He's a a great rebounder for his position. Really high field goal percentage. I was excited for Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. Then he tore his shoulder ligaments and he was out for the season. But then, given how hard a work he was back. And he did it again. We can look at what he did in his seven games and be pretty interested in it. But it's not enough of a sample size to know whether that's going to be the case moving forward. But the fact that he played seven games and 29 minutes of pop in those games when coming back from that shoulder injury is big to me. He had an on-off as positive 13.5, and that's obviously a huge number. Now, whether he... It's unlikely that he'd be able to sustain that sort of number for a whole season. Maybe he can, but he'd be one of the best players of all time if he could maintain that sort of a number for an entire season. In fact, I probably should have a look at what his on-off numbers were for the last season, just to see how it compared. Just bear with me while I bring that up. Where are we? Well, you know what? The season before, they were plus 12.2. So it's not a big difference. And that's how impactful that he can be defensively. And yes, people love jumping on a narrative. Kidd-Gilchrist, busted ass jumper, can't shoot, can't score. Well, that's sort of true, but it's also not really true because he has been able to increase his field goal percentage. And he's shooting 47%. I think that's pretty good. It's not a bad shot. And then we can look at what Kidd-Gilchrist did this season. And yes, it's only seven games, but the season before, 2014-15, Kidd-Gilchrist hit a total of 0 3-pointers. He also attempted a total of 0 3-pointers. The season before, he went 1 of 9 from three. The season before, he went 2 of 9 from three. So his first three seasons in the NBA, he went a combined 3 of 18, including one season where he went 0 for 0. Yep, we can all agree that that's terrible. This season, he played seven games. He took 7 threes in seven games. Remember, the season before, he took 0. He hit 3 of them. And this is as extraordinarily small a sample size as you can get. But he hit 43% of his threes. It is only 7 attempts, but the fact that he took 7 attempts in 7 games is the bigger factor to me than the fact that he hit 3 of them. Because it means he's got confidence. And this is a guy that is disciplined. And he takes the shots he knows he can hit. And he couldn't hit threes. So you know what he didn't do? He didn't take them. But in his 7-game cameo, he must have had so much more confidence in his 3-point shot that he went, I can hit these. And he did. Now, he won't be a 43% 3-point shooter next season. I'm happy to write that down and use it in the vault of things you can use against me. He won't. But if he's happy to take 1 3 a game and he can hit them at 36%, well, he becomes another level of good player. He's seen his minutes per game increase over the last couple of years from 24 to 29, over 29 in the 7 games. He should be getting close to 30-plus minutes. And again, if his offense comes together, then we're looking at some pretty good numbers. Now, he averaged per 36, he averaged 12.7 points in those 7 games, 0.5 threes, 6.5 rebounds, 0.4 steals, 0.4 blocks. I think that he can be a guy that gets you 0.6 blocks and a steal a game. He can hit you 0.5 threes, and he can be a 13.5 sort of player. And 50% field goal percentage should be the aim. Now, he's not a great free throw shooter, hovers around that 70 mark, but maybe that improves too. I'm giving you a lot of hype here on Michael Kidd-Gilchrist because I do really like him, and I do think that there's something to him as a player. He was fourth on the team in win shares per 48, and actually didn't have a great box score plus minus, a negative 0.7 defensively, which is not something that you normally associate with Kidd-Gilchrist. But again, the small sample size, he was a huge positive in both of the last two seasons in his defensive box score plus minus. It was his best PER season by far, and a true shooting of over 60 when he'd only been at 52 the year before. These are all, again, small samples. But Michael Kidd-Gilchrist is a player to me who he ranked 125th this season in 9-cat, 136th in 8-cat. He should be a top 100 player. There is almost no chance you need to draft him in the top 100, but he is a 12th or 13th round special to me. He is a dynasty acquisition target because I think that if he can start hitting threes, and again, I really trust his work ethic, and we've seen his work ethic. I trust his defense will keep him on the court. He's a good rebounder. The steals will come. I think that he can, again, like Cody Zeller, he probably doesn't project as a top 50 guy, but maybe a top 80 sort of player at some point in the next 2-3 seasons. I do really like Kidd-Gilchrist as an outside the top 100 pick who becomes a top 100 guy next season. Really excited to see what they do with him. And him coming back means they might not sign Courtney Lee. They push Batum to the two. They play Kidd Gilchrist at the three. They've got Williams at the four. Or if they don't re-sign Williams, they can go Kidd Gilchrist at the four, because he can play a small ball four role and play that minutes with Kaminsky, and then run, you know, Courtney Lee at the two and run Nick Batum at the three, or whatever they need to do. But he offers a lot of flexibility. He can play the three and the four. We've got Batum that plays the three and the two and even the four in some circumstances. Just a lot of... And Williams, who plays the three and the four as well. A lot of flexibility with this team, and Kidd Gilchrist is a player I'm pretty excited about. Jezza Lynn, he was criminally misused in Los Angeles last season. I couldn't have harped on about that enough on the podcast. Came across to Charlotte, signed the one-year deal, signed a two-year with a player option deal. He has declined that player option, which was he was due to make $2.2 million on. He is going to earn himself $10 million a year. I think there's almost no doubt in my mind that he will do that. And he had a pretty solid fantasy season, 173rd in 9-cat, but 142 in 8-cat. And he wasn't a guy that you owned all the way through, but there were times when players were injured, and he had to step up into a starting role. And when he did, he made DFS owners or DFS players a lot of money, and he was useful in your fantasy season. Now, depending on where he goes, if he plays 30 minutes a night, he's a top 100 player. If he plays 26 minutes a night, he's a guy you look at in 16 and 14 team leagues. In his 26 minutes, he averaged 12 points, 0.9 threes, 3 rebounds, 3 assists, 0.8 steals on 41 and 82%. Hit 33% of his three-pointers as well. It was a lot better than what we saw from him in LA. Basically the same amount of minutes. He scored more. He just looked better. And he should have been playing 30-plus minutes in LA last season. We know that. He was in a different role here in Charlotte, and he's going to make some pretty decent money. He might end up... Imagine him in Philadelphia. I think he'd be great there. In Brooklyn, really, I'd much prefer the Nets sign him than they sign Rajon Rondo. Lin is not that old. He's 27 years of age. He's 27 years of age. He's got a good couple of years in him. He's not an upper end. He's not top 15 point guard in the NBA. But he's good enough to be one of the top 30 guys, I think, and he can play as the two. And the Hornets would really love to have him back, but they're going to have to pay a lot of money to keep him. They're not getting him on a $2 million deal. That's the problem with Jeremy Lin. In terms of his advanced numbers, they were okay. Yeah, look, he was fifth on the team in win shares, you know, ahead of Al Jefferson, ahead of Frank Kaminsky. Win shares per 48, not quite so attractive when he was 15th on the team. But box score plus minus, he was a negative, but a negative 1.1, not a terrible number. Overall, he sort of is what he is, and he projects best to being that exactly the role that he played in Charlotte. But given the ability he's got to go out into the free agency market, he might find himself as a starter for 1 or 2 years. I think you'll be able to find him be a top 100 player for the next two seasons. I think that's a definite goal for him if he finds himself in a spot where he gets 30 minutes. And if his owner in a dynasty league doesn't believe he has top 120 value, I'd be acquiring him, because you're going to get two top 100. You know, it's a gamble, because say he settles for a team where he's a backup, then obviously he's, you know, outside the top 150. But there's a chance he'll be looking for a role where he gets 30 minutes a night. And there's a possibility of that in certain places. And then he becomes a real bargain and can become a top 90 player. But I don't know how long that sort of thing lasts for, unfortunately. Courtney Lee, a player that I did like talking about during the season as the player who does the least with the most amount of minutes. Advanced numbers really like him. 4.6 on-off in his time in Charlotte. And 9-cat, 122nd, and 148 in 8-cat. And that's all fine. But that's like his ceiling. Like, can he get any better than that? I don't think he really can. He played, you know, quite a big chunk of minutes for this team. And when he was in Memphis as well, he played 30 minutes a game for the season. And 9.5 points, and that's a ploppy number. He hit 1-3 a game, yeah, whatever. 2.6 rebounds, 1.7 assists, 1.1 steals, 0.4 blocks, 45 and 85. And hit 38% of his threes. A tremendously valuable real-life player. A horribly valuable fantasy player. He doesn't give you enough. He doesn't give you any sort of top 100 upside, in my opinion. And he's not a player that... I don't even care where he signs. Because he's going to sign somewhere. He's going to play 32 minutes a game. And he's going to do exactly the same thing. Score in single digits. Hit good percentages across the board. Have a couple of games where he gets, you know, he scores 20. But he doesn't do anything rebound-wise. Doesn't do anything assist-wise. He hits a decent amount of threes. He gets steals. That's sort of what he is. And he's a fine guy to add in and have on and off of rosters. I'm not really sure of where Courtney Lee's long-term fantasy vote. Well, I am sure it's not high. He's 30 years old as well. So how much better does he get from here? This is sort of who he is, and yeah, he's not going to be a standard league target for me next year, and I do not see him. He will sign a contract for 12, 15 million, you know, something around that, maybe 10, but I think he probably gets more than that. And you're going to go, okay, Courtney Lee, they've paid him to be a big part, and then they won't have, because he just won't. He just can't produce big fantasy numbers in big chunks. So he's a better real life player than fantasy player. I think that's pretty clear when you see what Courtney Lee can do. Overall, again, another positive defensive guy. You know, a defensive box score plus minus of one, but his offense does struggle. He is a good 3-point shooter, but again, he's just a very solid guy who really doesn't do anything to move the needle from a fantasy point of view. I don't think anyway. Jezza Lamb. I really like Jezza Lamb. I thought he was a player who did not get an opportunity in Oklahoma City. Scott Brooks was quite stubborn with not giving him an opportunity and should have. He came across to Charlotte in a deal for basically nobody and was playing a ton of minutes to start the season. And a lot of people were big into Jeremy Lamb. He was the 179th player for the season in 9-cat, 230 in 8-cat, but he started the season pre-All-Star at 131, and he was a top 100, top 70 guy for about the first month and a half of the season. And that's really impressive. But you had to really dig deep into it. Well, not even that deep. You had to just look at what he was doing, and that's what I did, and I was very much on board with, yeah, Jeremy Lamb's good, but it's not going to continue. He's not going to continue doing what he's doing because he was shooting just, you know, 60% a night, and it was just impossible to continue. And then you hear the reports coming out from Steve Clifford that we can't play Jeremy Lamb because he's not concentrating, he's not learning, he's not paying attention in meetings, all this sort of concentration-based stuff which kept him off the court throughout the playoffs. Now, a nice 3.6 on-off for the season, impressive. He's signed to a pretty cheap contract. He's signed for the next 3 years at less or 21 million. These are not expensive numbers for a 24-year-old. I do like him, but to me, I think that for him to sustain top 100 value for the season feels like a bit of a stretch. Now, maybe if Courtney Lee moves, he could fill a Courtney Lee role. I think that's sort of where he projects to be at some point in his career, is that guy who can knock down some threes and can play a little bit of defense, because he was just, but he was a positive defensive contributor by advanced metrics. He was an above average win shares guy. He was above average PER. He's just above average in sort of every category. And that's not going to be great for fantasy, but it's okay. Now, the numbers he put up for the season is 18 minutes, 8.6 points and 3.7 rebounds. Yep, 0.8 threes. He had 0.6 steals, 0.4 blocks, 45 and 73, hitting 31% of his threes. Now, he obviously needs to get the three-point percentage up, but at the start of the season, when he was hitting 65, 67, 70% of his shots, it was great right at while it lasted, but there was absolutely no way that it was going to, and I don't want to play the Vince McMahon drop again, but there was no chance in hell that he had of continuing it, and we saw it drop off, and we saw him fall out of the rotation when Courtney Lee arrived, yeah, to a degree. He still played 69 games, he battled some injuries, but he just couldn't be that same sort of player. And maybe he takes a step forward. If Lee leaves, there's a definite opportunity there for him, but he would need to be able to shoot at that high rate to do that. And to me, he remains more of a 14-team league guy who can hover around that 150 mark. And that's probably, yeah, probably his upside. Maybe he pushes into the top 120. Maybe. Frank Kaminsky. We know all the stories about Frank Kaminsky, that the Hornets turned down receiving 4 first-round draft choices from the Celtics so they could pick him. Cool. So he's has that on his head and on his shoulders for, you know, for his career, basically. He needs to turn into something good. On-off, really poor. Negative 5.9. That's not uncommon for a rookie. He was 224th in 9-cat full season, 247th for 8-cat. It didn't show much improvement throughout the course of the season, but still, 7.5 points in 22 minutes, 4.2 rebounds, he got half a steal, half a block, hit 0.8 threes, and 40 and 74 with 33 from three. As we know with rookies, he might be a 45, 46 guy next year. He might be 36 from three. He might take his free throws up to 80, which is all stuff that we expected him to be able to do coming out of college. So he does have some room to improve. They do think highly of him, and I think that's fair enough, because he was a solid player. He wasn't great. He wasn't spectacular, but I thought he was really solid at what he does. Now, pairing Kaminsky and Cody Zeller in the front court is probably not great, but Kaminsky's ability to shoot, and he hit almost a three a game in his 21 minutes. That's pretty impressive for a rookie. So I don't think that Kaminsky's a bust by any stretch. I think that he had a pretty solid season. You know, almost as good as you can hope for a rookie that you pick with pick 9. What more could you have hoped to get out of Frank in that sort of at that sort of spot or in his sort of role? I think that when you look at what his player comps, I had a look at them earlier, a lot of them projectors like guards, like, or small forwards, Danielle Marshall, Craig Elo, guys like Quincy Pondexter, guys like that. He's obviously too big to play that. His rebounding does need some work. But overall, I think it was a relatively successful rookie season for Frank. He was actually a positive defensively, which is something, again, which people thought would be a concern for him. And his offensive game can go up, you know, pretty significant levels. I think that Frank Kaminsky, you know, ranked 224th. If you're in a league that goes 300 deep, 350 deep, I don't think that he remains around 220. I think that he's definitely got top 140 upside. Yeah, maybe top 100 for a couple of seasons. Maybe he finds himself as a 75th ranked player for two or three seasons in his career when he hits 26, 27. That's a possibility for Kaminsky. I do think that it was a promising start to his career, and I think he can go a fair way further forward than this, and that's all that you're looking for in dynasty leagues. I think that he was really strong. It might not happen next season, but I do see an improvement from him in those percentages, and I do think that we can see him becoming a top 100 guy. There's definitely more than a zero chance of that happening. There's probably more than a 35% chance of that happening, would be my early guess at this point. And I'd say that, you know, overall I was impressed with what Kaminsky did. Spencer Hawes was lost in Los Angeles with the Clippers, came across to Charlotte as part of the Lance Stephenson deal, and sort of fits in amongst their team of let's have as many white centers as we can get. He was okay. I don't think there was anything super good about what Spencer Hawes did. He had back problems, which cost him a fair chunk of the season. He was a negative 1.3 on off, 242 in 9-cat and 248 in 8-cat leagues. He ended up playing 18 minutes, scoring almost 6 points and 0.6 threes and 4 rebounds, half a block, half a steal. Again, a pretty underrated defender, pretty underrated rim protector. He's an efficient shooter, much like Kaminsky, much like Cody Zeller in terms of their free throw percentages. He hit threes at 37%. He's a guy that you wouldn't hate having him as your backup center if, and not having Al Jefferson there. I don't think that's terrible. He's a better rim protector than what Jefferson is, in my opinion. He is a better mover. His ability to stretch the floor is better. But I don't think many people view him that way, or whether he's a better player than all those guys. But I thought overall, defensively, he was pretty good. He was a better defensive player by a defensive box score plus minus than what Jefferson was. His overall box score plus minus was better than what Jefferson's was. And he's... win shares not quite as high, but I still think that it was a success for him. And Spencer Hawes is only 27 years old. I don't think many people would realize that he is actually sort of not old, and he was decent. And given the contract that Spencer Hawes is on, he's on $6 million for next season and another $6 million player option the year after. If you can get Al Jefferson for, I don't think you're going to get Al Jefferson for $6 million. I don't mind keeping Hawes and keeping him there as that backup center behind Zeller, and play maybe a little bit of four, but that's probably not ideal. But he can play some four with Marvin Williams and Frank Kaminsky, but more as a backup center. I don't think that it's a terrible idea to just retain him as your backup center. He can do quite a few things, and I do think that he was super fantasy friendly in Philadelphia and Cleveland two seasons ago. He's never going to return to those sort of heights. I don't think he's just not going to be a player who's relied upon as a starter in any sort of situation, but he's going to be that deep league consistent guy who's in that top 250 mark and plays 17 minutes a night and hits his free throws and hits some threes and grabs a couple of rebounds and blocks half a shot. I think we see that from him for the next couple of seasons. Troy Daniels played 46 games. He played 11 minutes a game, but he had some real chances or some opportunities where he went crazy. Now, he only played 11 minutes a game, still hit 1.3 triples in that time. He hit 47% of his threes. He hit 46% of his total shots, so that's obviously a bit of a discrepancy there. He was only 57% from the free throw line. So 47 from three, 56 from three-point line. That's not something that happens all that often where a player is just that dismal from the line, but that outstanding in terms of hitting threes. But he's had a reputation as a three-point shooter. He actually had a 63% true shooting percentage. He was a positive on offense, a 1.6 in box score, but negative 2.7 in his defense. So that is a concern. He's a negative 9.4 in his on-off numbers. He ranked 310th in the league in 9-cat leagues, but per 36 NICAT, 67th. And that's because of the amount of three-pointers that he hit. Now, can he take a step up? Could he fill in some of Courtney Lee's minutes if he happened to leave? Or if Jeremy Lin leaves? Could he take on an extra 5-6 minutes a game as the shooting guard, some of Lin's two guard minutes? Yeah, absolutely. Do they love him? Yeah, I don't know if they love him. He's a restricted guy. I think they'd want to bring him back at the right price because that three-point shooting can be quite valuable. I'm just going to have a look at what his finishing around the rim was like, his shooting percentages in close. If we have a look at that, where are we? He shot 57% at the rim, which is not a great number. But look, 48% from three. He shot 53% between 16 feet and the three-point line. 53%. Mid-range, horrific. 25% between 10 and 16 feet, and 40% between 3 and 10 feet, and only 57% at the rim. So just really much better when he gets open space and when he's able to hit 61% of his corner threes. Some of these shooting numbers are just out of control for him, but he needs to be in the right spot. I think that he can be a guy that does maybe have one season of cracking the top 250, but I wouldn't be having huge hopes on Troy Daniels, but he's a great three-point streamer. If injuries hit the team and he's forced into 24 minutes, then you can get two threes a game out of him over a stretch of a week. And his defense will burn him, and that'll probably ever stop him from being a 30-minute-a-game guy. But still some interesting stuff to like with Troy Daniels. Jorge Gutierrez played 15 games and played 5 minutes a game and averaged 1.3 assists. And that's your Jorge Gutierrez update. Seriously, though, I don't think there's much to really talk about Jorge. He's a free agent coming up this season. He's a restricted free agent. He's 27 years of age. He showed a little bit, but he's not ideal. But this team's going to need a backup point guard. If Lin walks, maybe they do bring Gutierrez back. Maybe they use pick 22 on a point guard. Maybe they look at Aaron Harrison as being that guy, but he's more of a 2 than a point. We'll talk about him in a second, but not a lot to really hang your hat on for Gutierrez. Tyler Hansbrough, similar situation. Played 8 minutes a game, grabbed 2 boards, had 2 points, 45 and 56%. There's a chance he doesn't end up anywhere in the NBA next season. And that's fine. We know what his limitations are. He's never going to have a big enough role to really... Even if your league goes 300 deep, Psycho T is not going to be a real contributor. He was 421st this season. I don't think that there's much hope for him to do much moving forward. Now, Aaron Harrison played just 24 games and 4 minutes a game and shot horrifically. 26% from the field, 42% from the free throw line, 30% from three. Aaron Harrison had a true shooting percentage of 37. That is just dismal. 4.3 as a PER. He was a negative 5.6 offensive box score plus minus. He was negative in win shares. There was nothing to like about Aaron Harrison. I'm not massively keen on him moving forward, but again, they could need some backup guards. They might lose Lin, they might lose Lee, they might lose Gutierrez, they might lose Daniels. There's going to be some guard minutes there for somebody. Now, whether they feel any trust, which they shouldn't, in Aaron Harrison remains to be seen. Let's look at what he did in the D League and see if there's anything we can really like there, and honestly, there's not. He played 13 games, he played 30 minutes a game and went 17.5 points, 3.5 rebounds, 2 assists. He shot 36 from the field, 27 from 3. He shot 82 from the free throw line. And his advanced numbers were poor in the D League. He was a negative 4 box score plus minus. He was 0.3 win shares. He was less than 15 PER. Nothing really stands out to me about Aaron Harrison. I wouldn't be gambling on him thinking that he's going to take the jump and become a top 100 player at any point in his future. All right, I'm going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back to answer your questions regarding the Charlotte Hornets. I saw your picture today. Got me thinking about the things that I would say. But I know you're happy now and you're someplace far away. Away, away, away. And I can't remember the way you taste, you taste, you taste. I walk down your old street and I wonder if I'll ever meet again without a second glance. questions that you guys asked either on Twitter or on Facebook, and you can also ask them in the forums over on Fantrax. And if you're unaware of what Fantrax is the best place to play your fantasy leagues. It is the most comprehensive, it is the most customizable fantasy league host. It covers all sports, so football, basketball, college football, golf, NASCAR, baseball, hockey, whatever you want to do. Fantrax is the place to go. We're hosting all the Red Rock Dynasty Leagues over and all the Red Rock Listener Leagues over on Fantrax. There is plenty of options for the casual player and for the more serious one with a premium commissioner option, contracts, salaries, draft, pick swaps, future years, all that stuff that you can't do on ESPN, the stuff that you can't do on Yahoo, where you've got to have your own, you know, league message boards or you've got to have your own spreadsheets. Forget about that. Fantrax does it all for you. Go and check out the site, sign up, just read the options, just create a fake league and see what you can do. And you'll be astounded and you'll get the complex league feeling tingling in your loins. You'll get a dynasty league thought process happening and you'll want to get stuff started over on Fantrax. I can't recommend it enough. You know what, if you want to do a league that starts at the All-Star break, you can do it on Fantrax. You can't do it on ESPN, you can't do it on Yahoo. If you want to run a playoff basketball fantasy league, you can't do it on those places, but you can do it on Fantrax. You can do whatever you want over on Fantrax. They have almost any option you can imagine, plus more that you can't even imagine. So check out Fantrax.com and consider moving your league over there and get started in some more complex and dynasty and salary cup leagues, like the Red Rock 30-team league, which we're on our way to filling our second one of those ones. The invites for the first one have all been sent out. We're about ready. Over the next 3 or 4 days, we'll get ready to do the drawings of the draft slot selection process to see who gets to pick where and pick which NBA team is going to represent them. And if you're unfamiliar with the rules in that draft, we go through all 30 teams, you generate a spot, and you don't get a draft pick. You get to choose a draft pick. So if you get first pick, you go, I want to pick one. I want to pick 30. I want to pick 20. And what you do there in that league is if you got selection one, you pick your draft slot. And that means you get, if you pick one, you get your choice of any NBA team and you get one player off that NBA team. If you pick 20, 19 people ahead of you pick their NBA teams and then you pick your NBA team. So you might have pick 20 and you might get, say, the Jazz. And then you get, in the first round, you have to take someone from the Jazz. You might take Gordy Haywood, you might take Rudy Gobert, you might take Rod Hood, you might take Derek Favors, whoever you take, you got to take someone from the Jazz. But then in the second to 13th round, if you picked at pick 20, you pick then at pick 11 every round after that. If you pick at pick 1 and you take the Warriors and take Curry first, that means you pick at pick 30 in the round. So you pick at pick 1, you pick 60, you pick 90. If you pick 30, you get 30, you get 31, you get 61, you get 91. So there's a lot of strategy involved, and I'm sure those guys are looking forward to seeing what actual draft selection or NBA team slot selection they get to pick. Because the person who gets the first choice might not pick 1. They might pick 30. They might pick 7. It's a lot of strategy that goes into it. Start thinking if you're in that league. And if there is still some spots left in the second league, again, I've got stacks and merge the two words into stuns. I actually did that the other day. I was talking to a customer at work at the pharmacy, and I told them they needed to go down to I was trying to tell them they either need to go down to the front to pay for it, or I told them they needed to go down to the counter. I merged the words counter and front into one word, and it came out quite aggressively rude, and I had to apologize pretty profusely. Thankfully, they didn't speak a huge amount of English, so they didn't quite understand exactly what I was saying. I just dropped it. Sorry. Don't really know if that they caught it, but when you combine counter and front into one word that starts with C and ends in NT, it's not a great look as a professional. But anyway, that's a completely off-the-record story. And if you're still listening to this podcast at this point and hearing tales from the dispensary bench, I do applaud you. Let's get into your listener questions. I've already answered Justin Goodeman's about who's my fantasy life partner, but let's get into Ben Clark. Ben Clark's a member of the Red Rock 30-team league. He says, is drafting Kaminsky over Winslow and Turner the dumbest move since Stauskas? The year before. It wasn't great, given the way that those two guys, Winslow and Turner, have both looked. I think Miles Turner on this team would look sensational. Winslow, yeah, I think Michael Kidd-Gilchrist is almost a Winslow sort of player. Miles Turner would have been incredible, I reckon, on this team. It's just a tremendous wing, rim defender, guy who can hit some threes. I think he would have looked great on this team. Winslow, Yeah, I suppose with Kid Gilchrist injured, he would have been a pretty solid fit. I'm not sure how he goes with Batum there, but I can completely understand the Turner situation. Ben also asks, do the Hornets pivot to rebuild mode if they can't keep Batum or keep swinging for the 8 seed? Michael Jordan's not a rebuild sort of guy. He's happy with sort of pushing for that just a playoff spot. It really helps in the market they're in to try and get playoff revenue to keep themselves relevant. It is hard for them to really do full-on rebuilds. I'm 95% confident they keep Batum. If they don't, I don't think that they'll go fully in the tank because they'll have Kemba still, they'll have Kid Gilchrist that can play in that spot. They'll look to attract, and they've attracted, they attracted Al Jefferson as a free agent. They can get something. They're not a great team, but I think the Michael Jordan allure is big. Lin came across on a really cheap deal, and the Jordan thing is part of it. And I think that they will still sort of push, but I reckon Batum can see something building for this team and being a conference finals team in the next 2 seasons. I think that's a possibility for this team. And I think Batum will stay. But if he leaves, I don't think they move into full rebuild. I don't think they're shipping out Kemba. I don't think they're doing any of those sort of things. Irv Dizzle on Twitter at Irvy1Kenobi with underscores in between those three words. He says, who would benefit the most from Batum, Big L leaving? Well, I've talked about Jefferson enough. It's Zeller, but Zeller's going to have that role regardless. If Batum leaves... Well, it's a good question because it all depends on Courtney Lee. If he's still there, you would think that Kid Gilchrist is still going to play a role regardless if Batum is there or not. I think that Kemba Walker suffers if Batum goes, but they're going to have to try and bring someone in. Maybe they bring in my other French boyfriend, Evan Fournier. He would fit pretty nicely along the wing there. Troy Daniels would get a bump in his minutes. But again, all these guys, Lee, Lin, Batum, Daniels, we don't know they're going to be on this team next season. There's quite a bit of fluctuation across the wing here, and it's really hard to judge at this point, Irv. Blizzard of Shame, who's on Twitter, at Rye Spicer, he says, Miami gets Batum in the offseason, right? Right? Wrong. No, he's not going to Miami. That's not happening, Rye, unfortunately for you, so I think you can keep dreaming. Eric24, who's on Twitter, at EricMamba24, wonder who his favorite player is. He says, keep or trade Lin. Not up to them. They can't trade him because they don't have him. He's declined his player option. He is an unrestricted free agent. They would love to keep him. They're going to have to pay $10+ million to keep him, though. And whether they do that remains to be seen. I think that it would be great if they could, but it might be fiscally impossible. Nick Hatcher. This is probably the first Charlotte Hornets fan I've spoken to on Twitter. Nick Hatcher, who's on Twitter at nhatcherson. How good can we be if we, and there you go, we, that's why I know he's a Hornets fan. Just yesterday I did the Atlanta Hawks podcast. I don't know if I've got any followers who are Hawks fans. If you're listening to this podcast and you're a Hawks fan, which would be odd, maybe you don't like the Hornets and you'd be still listening. If you are a Hawks fan, can you please tweet at me? I'd like to know. Anyway, Nick says, how good can we be if we re-sign Batum, if MKG stays healthy without improving jumper and get some semblance of rim protection? Well, you've got a semblance of rim protection. You've got Cody Zeller who can do that. Spencer Hawes is decent at it. How good can you be? There's no reason why you can't be the 3rd seed in the East again. There's no reason why you can't challenge for the 2 seed. I think that this team can be really good. An extra year of development for Kaminsky, an extra year of fit for Batum. Dealing with that 2-guard spot is... it's not that all that... because Batum will slide down and Kid Gilchrist will come in at the 3. But you need some depth. You need a backup point guard. You need a backup 2. You need a backup 3. That's where they should be spending their focus. But yeah, you can definitely challenge for that, 3rd seed again. Joseph Diffenbach, let's round out the podcast with a Joseph Diffenbach question. How will the Zeller/Jefferson situation shake out moving forward? I'll give my thoughts on that, Joseph. I'd like to know your opinion. I'd like to know everyone's opinion. How many people think that Jefferson will be re-signed and play over Zeller? I think it's not happening. It is Zeller to me. Zeller is the starting center. He might be a starting center that plays 27 minutes, but he is the starting center, and I think that will remain the way forward for this team. We are done for today's podcast, guys. If this is one of the first podcasts that you've seen from me, welcome. I hope you enjoy it. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes, or you can subscribe on YouTube. You can find it in iTunes. You can find it on Stitcher. You can find it in TuneIn. You can find it in Overcast. And I am going to try and get it up into the Google Play Music Store. I don't know if that helps people or not on Android. Again, let me know if it is helpful. I'm going to submit it there and get it started over on Google Play as well. Follow me on Twitter at redrock_bball. Check out Fantrax. Of course, you know about Basketball Monster, the best site for fantasy basketball tools, season long and DFS stuff. When we kick off again next season, which we're looking to open around the end of August, start of September with Basketball Monster, make sure you're signing on there and in for a full season of fun and frivolity with myself, Kyle and Matt, and everything happening over on Basketball Monster. Don't forget to check out all the podcasts and articles that get released on Hardwood Proxism as well. This podcast is part of the Hardwood Proxism Basketball Network, so check out everything over there as well. Enjoy the finals today or tomorrow, depending on when you're listening to this. We are done here, guys. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.